Sometimes I get so angry when I read the news online. Then I click on Israel National Radio. They make me feel so good about being Jewish. I download their free podcasts.
Download complete.
And listen to them on the bus. Israel National Radio really soothes my nerves.
The program you're about to listen to is a rebroadcast of a past program.
Israel National Radio presents Light Unto the Nations with Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Shalom Aleichem, Jews, Gentiles, and nations of the world. Ari Abramowitz, Jeremy Gimpel, here once again on Israel National Radio, bringing you a light onto the nations.
So we have a very special show today. We have with us the author of a book called Israel Lobby. He's an endowed chair at University of Chicago. This book has been a bestseller. I believe it's a New York Times bestseller. His name is John Mearsheimer. And first of all, John, I want to thank you for coming to the show, because many have said that, for obvious reasons, you wouldn't join us, that you wouldn't come on to Israel National Radio and explain your book, Israel Lobby. And it's really a testimony to your sense of fair play. Because, you know, although you and Professor Walt have written this book in a very academic and sophisticated way, I couldn't help but hearing, and many people couldn't help but hearing, the overtones of good old-fashioned anti-Semitism. Now, I know that you say that these are smears and misrepresentations, and I want you to explain and defend it. But the question is that, you know, the Nazis, they accused the Jews of controlling in secret the U.S. government to hurt non-Jews, and the Protocols of Learned Elders of Zion, they also, you know, they made claims that Jews controlled the entire world. And your book portrays Israel and neocons of manipulating the United States with, you know, tentacles in the administration and the State Department that's disproportionate. And you make a point that I think is very important to highlight for people all over the world, where you say this is not about American Jews, because you pointed out that American Jews supported the Iraqi war 10% less than the average American. So this is not necessarily the old-fashioned anti-Semitism, and really, Professor Mearsheimer, I'm eager to hear what you have to say, because people say that this is the real threat against Jews, the sophisticated anti-Semitism. You know, Martin Luther King, he says that anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism. He says that the anti-Semite rejoices at any opportunity to vent his malice. The Times have made it unpopular in the West to proclaim openly a hatred of Jews. This being the case, the anti-Semite must constantly seek new forms and forums for his poison. This is Martin Luther King. How he must revel in this new masquerade. He does not hate the Jews. He's just an anti-Zionist. Let my words echo in the depths of your soul, he continues to say. When people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. Make no mistake about it. Professor Mearsheimer, welcome to the show. What do you have to say?
Well, let me make a number of points. First of all, the general tenor of your comments bear little resemblance to what's in the book, and I would strongly recommend that listeners actually look at the book to see that what we say in the book bears little resemblance.
So would I. It's a worthwhile read.
Let me make two particular points. The first is that we're not talking about the Jewish lobby. We're talking about the Israel lobby. And it's very important to emphasize that not all American Jews identify in any meaningful way with Israel and could, by any stretch of the imagination, be categorized as part of the Israel lobby. Furthermore, it's important to emphasize that some of the strongest proponents of Israel in the United States, some of the key members of the Israel lobby, are not Jewish. And here I'm talking about the Christian Zionists. So we call it an Israel lobby, not a Jewish lobby. The second and most important point is to understand that interest groups politics is at the heart of the American political system. And what the Israel lobby is doing is acting like a normal interest group. It's acting like the National Rifle Association, like the farm lobby, like the Cuba lobby. Our argument is not that this is...
But you do say it's grossly disproportionate, that they have
power.
It did
not use the word grossly. It is
very.
But so is the National Rifle Association. And we also argue that the policies that the National Rifle Association and the farm lobby are pushing are not good for the United States. There's nothing wrong with arguing that the policies that any interest group, be it the NRA or the Israel lobby, is pushing are not good for the United States. So we're not saying that this is a cabal or a conspiracy. In fact, it's just a normal American interest group that happens to be especially powerful. There's no question about that, and hardly anyone would deny that here in the United States.
Well, Ari asked, though, he said that an anti-Zionist today, as Zionism in the state of Israel is the Jew amongst the nations, is in fact an anti-Semite.
We're not anti-Zionist. As you know from reading the book, we make it perfectly clear that we think it's a wonderful thing that there's a state of Israel. We think that the United States should support the existence of Israel, and if Israel's existence is threatened, the United States should come to its support. But at the same time, we believe that Israel is a normal country, which means that it sometimes pursues foolish policies, as the United States does, and furthermore, its interests are not always the same as the United States, and therefore there will be cases when the United States should distance itself from Israel and put pressure on Israel. But that's not anti-Zionism or anti-Semitism. In fact, it's saying that Israel is a normal country. We're not in favor of treating it any differently than we treat Britain, France, India, or Germany.
Well, in your book, you say that in the past, America had a moral obligation to Israel because of the Holocaust, and that moral obligation, that moral imperative, no longer exists. Could you explain that?
No, that's not our argument. Our argument is that the United States has a moral obligation to maintain the existence of Israel. It does not have a moral obligation to support everything that Israel does. For example, I do not think we have a moral obligation to support Israel's treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. But that does not mean we're anti-Zionist or against the existence of Israel. It just means that we think that that particular policy by the state of Israel is not in America's interest. And by the way, we don't think it's in Israel's interest either.
So the policies that you would advocate, because I understand what you're saying, that you're supporting policies that are not in Israel or America's best interest, either of them. But
correct.
The policies that you would advocate, such as Oslo and territorial compromise, have proven in the past to really put Israel in danger. You know, you say that Israel takes money from the United States, and that due to that control, really what the essence of the problem is that is payment with which the U.S. ruling elite is purchasing control of the Israeli foreign policy to hurt Israeli interests in exactly the same policies that you would advocate are good and strong.
No, we're not making that argument. We're simply making the argument that the Israel lobby, which is a powerful interest group, makes sure that the United States backs Israel no matter what it does. For example, take the Lebanon War in the summer of 2006. Most American strategists understood from the beginning that this was a fool's errand, that the Israelis were pursuing a foolish policy in southern Lebanon. But it was almost impossible in the United States to criticize Israel because the lobby insisted that we act as cheerleaders. This was not in Israel's interest. It was not in America's interest. And what we're calling for is a situation where Americans are free to criticize Israel when it pursues policies that normal Americans think don't make sense. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Israelis, certainly I would include you two in this, criticize your government when you think it's doing foolish things in the same way that Steve Walt and I criticize our government when it's pursuing foolish policies. But here in the United States, it's very difficult, if not almost impossible, in the mainstream media to criticize Israel for any policy.
But the policies that you're advocating for example, the expulsion of all of the Jewish people from Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, and the establishment of a Palestinian state, undermines the moral basis of our alliance with America and Israel. I mean, the alliance that we have isn't based in politics or economics, but it's based on the fact that we're the only country in the Middle East that represents the values that the United States stands for: freedom, justice, equality, truth, and compassion. The ethics that you take for granted for in America, they don't exist here in the Middle East, and we're a beacon of light in a sea of totalitarian dictatorships, and we're here to bring that light, and that America sees that as its role. Now, what's happening is, I want to understand, you advocate for this ethnic cleansing of the Jewish people from the Judea, Samaria, Gaza, what you would call the West Bank, if the establishment of a Palestinian state, there can't be one single Jew. But in Israel, there's 1.5 million Arabs. How do you equate that? Are those the morals and the values that we are united in?
Well, let me make 2 points. First of all, we're not calling for the ethnic cleansing of the Jews from the West Bank. We think that the settlements should have never been established, that the settlements were wrong, and that it's imperative that the Palestinians, like the Jews, have their own state. And the only way that the Palestinians can have a viable state of their own is if the settlements, or most of the settlements in the occupied territories, are dismantled. I don't view that as ethnic cleansing, and I think it's in Israel's interest. Second, with regard to the point that the United States and Israel have similar values, and you're basically representing our values there in the Middle East. There's some truth in that, in that both countries are democracies, and I have no doubt that Israel is a vibrant democracy. But the fact of the matter is that Israel is a fundamentally different country than the United States in the sense that Israel is a Jewish state. It's a state that privileges Jews both in theory and in practice. The United States is not a Christian state. The United States is a liberal state that treats all of its citizens equally. It's a secular state.
But at the same time,
that's a fundamental difference.
That's not really the values that we're talking about, because you yourself say that the Jewish people do deserve to have one state. The Arabs have 23. We should be able to have one state the size of Long Island. But at the same time, I'm talking about the morals that the Jewish people in the land of Israel represent. And that's the example of the blurring of values that I'm talking about, the equating of violence between the Palestinians and the Israelis. To equate a terrorist blowing up a school bus and a soldier protecting those school children, calling it then a cycle of violence, is simply wrong. A robber and a policeman are not both bad because they both have guns. They're people that are defending, and they're people that are attacking. In 1948, they wanted to wipe us off the map. In 1967, they wanted to wipe us off the map. In 1973, while all of the Jewish people were fasting on Yom Kippur, they once again tried to annihilate all of the Jews in the land of Israel. And here we are defending ourselves, and today the Palestinian elected government, the Hamas, still say, we want to annihilate all of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. To equate the violence is another blurring of the values. We represent those values even though we're still a Jewish country, because it's those Jewish values that America was founded on. It's those Torah values that are based in the Bible that America is founded on. That's why we're here. We're trying to spread that idea of equality and justice and truth to the world, that America sees truth and value in it.
Let me make a number of points there. First of all, I wouldn't ascribe too much similarity to Christian and Jewish values and posit too much of a historical link between those two groups. As you well know, we have a rich history of anti-Semitism in the Christian world, and Jews have been treated far better in the Islamic world over time than they have been in the Christian world. So let's not glorify behavior of Christians and the close alliance over time between Christian and Jews. Secondly, I think that your history is a bit simplistic. I think there's no question that there are groups in the Middle East now and in the past who wanted to destroy Israel, and there have been wars fought with that thought in mind, but not always. I don't think, for example, the 1973 war was a war that the Egyptians and the Syrians launched for the purposes of destroying Israel. I think it's a much more complicated picture than you make it out to be.
Well, the point is, though, that the Hamas today still, they're not freedom fighters, they're Jew fighters, and they want to kill all of the Jews. That's their charter. But here's the question. This is the part of the book that, honestly, that I couldn't, it threw me off so much. This is a direct quote from your book, because you position Israel, this little tiny post stamp in this sea of Arabs, as the bully of the area, as the Zionist oppressors. And this is the quote. Contrary to popular belief, the Zionists had larger, better equipped, and better led forces during the 1948 and 1949 War of Independence. And I looked up the stats, and Israel had 3 tanks. The Arabs had 270 tanks. The aircrafts of Israel were 35, where the Arabs had 300. The artillery was 5, where the Arabs had 150. The Arabs were a professional army from all different nations, and the Jews were a small group of freedom fighters. If you're right in your claims, why distort the truth to try to prove your point?
First of all, we didn't distort the truth, and listeners who have any doubts should read our book, and they should read the work of authors like Benny Morris on what actually happened in the 1948 war. And it's quite clear that the Israelis were the David, were not the David, and were instead the Goliath. I would ask you, if the Jews were so hopelessly outnumbered in 1948 and in subsequent wars as well, why is it that they've won every war?
I'll tell you that's a wonderful question. There's two reasons. One is a logical reason. Because the Jews were fighting for their lives, the Arabs could always turn around and go home. The Jews knew that if they lost this war, their women would be raped, their children would be slaughtered, and they would be thrown into the sea. And when you're pushed into a corner and you have no one else to do, a fierce fighter emerges that can't be compared with just another army that's fighting a war they don't really understand. And the other reason is because the God of Israel has brought the Jewish people back to the land of Israel. And we're here because our claim is that it's our biblical and historical birthright. It's always been the Jewish people's homeland. And if we don't have a right to Hebron, then we don't have a right to Tel Aviv, because it's always been our home. That's the reason why we're here, and that's the reason why we're going to stay here.
Well, I'm glad that the Jews are going to stay in Israel. Again, we fully support the existence of Israel. But I think if the Israelis stay in the West Bank and they continue to control the Gaza Strip as they now do, that Israel, as Prime Minister Olmert has made clear, is going to end up looking like South Africa. It's going to be an apartheid state, and it's going to be very difficult to generate much sympathy for Israel in Europe and in the United States.
I'm just wondering, if we take your stance and we disengage from Judea and Samaria, as we did from Gaza, do you not see mortars and Qassam rockets and more terrorists just now building a second terrorist state to then annihilate this Jewish state? Why would there be any difference between Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem than there is in Gaza? Wouldn't it just continue? If their charter is to annihilate the Jewish people in the land of Israel, why would that change by appeasing them and giving them what they're asking for?
First of all, there's no question that the Israelis cannot pull out of the West Bank and create a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank and in Gaza until Hamas, or the Palestinians more generally, come to accept the existence of Israel. So Israel pulling out of the occupied territories and agreeing to the formation of a Palestinian state is only the first step in the process. It's quite clear that the Palestinians have to buy a final agreement like that. Second point I would make to you is that pulling out of the Gaza Strip was never going to lead to peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis, because pulling out of the Gaza Strip did not leave the Palestinians with a viable state. The only hope we have here for creating peace between Israel and the Palestinians is to give the Palestinians a viable state, and that means giving them almost all of the West Bank and giving them the Gaza Strip and doing everything possible to give them a viable state. But that didn't happen when the Israelis pulled out of Gaza. In fact, the Palestinians ended up like caged animals inside that narrow piece of real estate.
Well, then having two little blotches of lands, one in Gaza and one in Judea and Samaria, and then having a bridge over it or a tunnel under it, and then that being a viable state, doesn't really seem like much of an option either. Why aren't you advocating for Jordan to be the Palestinian state? I mean, 80% of Jordanians are in fact Palestinians. There's a natural border. There's the majority of the Palestinians there are being ruled by a minority of Hashemite. Why isn't this call for justice of a minority oppressing a majority being called for you in Jordan?
Well, I'm not defending the political situation in Jordan or Egypt or Iran or any other country in the region. We're talking about the situation that exists inside what used to be called Mandate Palestine, between the Palestinians on one hand and the Israeli Jews on the other. And I think it's in the interest of Israel to create a Palestinian state on most of the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And I think that's what the Palestinians would like. I think, however, that's not likely to happen. Instead, you're going to get a greater Israel. And inside that greater Israel, you're eventually going to have more Palestinians than Jews. And I think this would be disastrous for the state of Israel.
Well, here's the question I have. You know, you're talking about the necessity of having a viable Palestinian state, and that a necessary part is that Hamas accept Israel. But could it possibly be that as a professor in America, in academia, that you see the world through a prism of you know, nationalism and economic factors, and you possibly won't go over into their world, into their worldview, and you project your own onto them. And I'll tell you why the Hamas would never accept it. Islam means submission, and a fundamental tenet of Islam is jihad, world domination. And the very fact that Israel would exist even as one square block in Tel Aviv would mean that Allah is not the ultimate God, and Islam is not the ultimate religion. And that is what it's about. This is a religious war, and when one is forced to always try to see it through this prism of academia in the United States, you know, they're saying first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. This isn't even about Jerusalem. They say that they value Jerusalem. Jerusalem is nowhere in the Quran. It's over 700 times in the Torah. You know, Ahmadinejad in Iran, this is absolutely a spiritual and religious war for him, and I doubt you would even debate that. You know, he says, when he was addressing the United Nations, the first line that he said was, "O mighty Lord, I pray to you to hasten the emergence of your last repository, the promised one, the perfect and pure human being, the one that will rule this world in justice and peace," which is, you know, he introduced this idea of Mahdaviyat, the right guardian of the Muslim Messiah, and he sees himself, he even built a grand avenue in Iran for the Mahdi to come down. And he believes that, you know, Allah was speaking through him when he addressed the United Nations. This is what we're facing. It's a religious war and it's a spiritual war. And when you try to confine it to the prism of academia, and you just are not able to see the picture.
See, this isn't just the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is a conflict of jihad against the rest of the world. If you look at Bosnia, Chechnya, the Philippines, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, every single conflict in the world is the same exact issue.
Not every conflict, just about.
Almost every conflict in the world. Not every... The bottom line is, this is a religious war, and to try to battle this war on a political thing, that the Palestinians are different than the Syrians, and the Syrians are different than the Iranians, and each war in their own thing has its own political mask, instead of really realizing this isn't a war on terror, this is a war on jihadic Islam that's trying to take over the world. And they're not just after Israel. Once Israel falls, God forbid, America would be the very next target. Our fighting here is to defend the people of America. We're on the front lines protecting the people of America, because the same exact spiritual people that are bombing our buses and shooting Qassam rockets into our land are the same people that are blowing up the World Trade Center.
Professor Mersharmer, you have a minute, 20 seconds left. You have the last word. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say that not many people in the United States, inside and outside of academia, would accept that description of the threat that the United States and Israel faces from the Arab and Islamic world. Second point I would make to you is that when I was young, many people argued about Yasser Arafat and the PLO, much the way you argue about Hamas. The argument was that Arafat would never change his stripes and that he would remain a terrorist committed to the destruction of Israel forever and ever. And I believe that Arafat did change his stripes and he did come to accept the existence of Israel. Second point I would make to you is that I think that most people in the Arab and Islamic world understand that Israel is a fact. It's not going away. A country that has the most powerful conventional forces in the military, hundreds of nuclear weapons, and the support of the United States is not going away. And I think most people are trying to figure out how to live with Israel. And I don't see any reason why some sort of agreement can't be struck between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which I think would be to Israel's interest and the United States' interest as well.
We're in the Middle East, not the Middle West. But Professor Mersheimer, we're very grateful that you joined us today. We appreciate it very much. And we'll be in touch. We'd love to speak with you in the future. Shalom.
Thank you. Bye.
Mikvahcalendar.com is your rabbinically approved personal guide to Torah to Mishpacha observance. Times and dates are automatically calculated and explained in English and Hebrew. Anywhere you are, sunrise and sunset are automatically adjusted. Receive email or text messages for important dates and times. May divine blessings of spiritual and material well-being continue to rain down and permeate your marriage and your home. Visit www.mikvahcalendar.com. That's MIKVAHCALENDAR.com.
There is a famous segula that a person who goes to the Western Wall for 40 consecutive days to pray for one request will have that request answered. There is also a long-standing tradition of giving charity to have a pious Jew pray in your place, since not everyone is able to make such a journey. Western Wall Prayers, 40 Days of Prayer for You at the Kotel, is a project of Kollel Tfilat Moshe. Visit westernwallprayers.org. That's westernwallprayers.org.
Light Unto the Nations with Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom and welcome back to A Light Unto the Nations. Ari Abramowitz here with Jeremy Gimpel. We just had on Professor Mearsheimer, who is, along with Professor Stephen Walt, is an author of the book Israel Lobby, which is a very contentious book and really says that, you know, Israel and AIPAC and the neocons of America are undermining America's best interest by supporting Israel and leading America down a path of destruction. That's the bottom line. That's what it's about. We had him on the show, and honestly, I'm grateful to him and respectful. I respect the fact that he came on the show because a lot of people just wouldn't. And he came on the show. And thank goodness I had with me my commander and my best friend, who is just like the best. He's just a brilliant guy on the battlefield with a microphone in front of him. And, you know, I'd love to hear what all of your thoughts are out there about that debate. You know, we're just getting into this. But something in my gut says we should be doing this more often. It's just fun. It's good. It really, you know, sparks controversy. And when you're debating someone, you're really both sides. If they're seeking truth, then they're whittling it down. And Jeremy just had a good point in that when I said you have the last minute 20, I didn't want to, like, interrupt him when he's like, well, you know, people said that about Arafat, and we all know Arafat. Fat changed his stripes. I felt like shooting myself in the head. I mean, we all know. Maybe speak for yourself. I don't know what kind of delusional world you're living in.
I only wanted the debate to be a little bit longer, the discussion to be a little bit longer, so we'd be able to, like, just address more of those issues. Let's talk about Arafat, for example. Arafat changing his stripes, that's one of the most ludicrous ideas I've ever heard. I mean, it's actually documented that a few days after Arafat shook Rabin's hand on the White House lawn, the very next day he went on Jordanian TV, because 80% of Jordanians are Palestinians. He was speaking to his Palestinian constituency. And he said, let this Oslo Accord be known to all that this is just a reference to the Palestine National Council decision of 1974, which of course is referring to the plan of phases, that the Palestinians will do all in their power to negotiate and receive as much land as possible and then use that land as a base to destroy the rest of Israel. A few days after he signed the Oslo Accord, he said exactly what his purpose was. There was no stripes changing. There was no change of mind. Their purpose has always been the destruction of the state of Israel. It always was, and it always has been, and it is today. There were no changing of stripes today. We all know that Arafat changed his stripes. If that's the proof that there was a chance for peace in the Middle East, that's totally ridiculous.
Now, here's the question I have for you, Jeremy. Do you think, you know, we can't know his motivations, but to me, the book is very polished, and it takes very much care to deal with all of the objections that one could have, saying that it's anti-Semitic and that it's this and that it's that. And he says, no. He's able to, you know, wiggle his way out of all of these accusations. Do you think that he's an anti-Semite intentionally, that he's an anti-Semite, that this is, a deeper coming from a deeper place, or that that he's not really an anti-Semite, but these are just the beliefs that he's adopted based on flawed logic, spurious thinking? What do you think it is?
I'll tell you. I have two answers. One is the benefit of the doubt that I'd like to give to the professor, because the fact that he came on Israel National Radio and had the debate, that's a credit to him. The fact that he's actually willing to talk it out, to share his views, hear our views, and let the truth speak for itself is in and of itself praiseworthy. And I think that possibly what happened was that, you know, when you come from a totally secular background, and your entire worldview is from a certain prism, but that prism, that initial way you see the world, is faulty, then all of the castle that you build on that foundation will be wrong.
All the extrapolations and the facts that come, yeah.
All the way to
conclusions of that nature.
Exactly. So at the same time, I have to go back to Masaryk. Masaryk was one of the only European leaders who helped the Jewish people during our independence. And one of the reporters of Ma'ariv went up to Masaryk and said, well, tell us, you know, what is it? Why are you different? How is it that that you love Israel? He's like, listen, I want you to know that I'm an anti-Semite. And Ma'ariv said, you're an anti-Semite? How could that possibly be? You're the only one that helped us. And he's like, I want you to know that I'm an anti-Semite, and most non-Jews are anti-Semites. And if they tell you otherwise, they're lying to you. I have an inner desire to hate the Jewish people, and I fight that desire every day because I know that it's wrong. But I want you to know that I have this inborn, or that I was raised to, and I know that it's wrong.
Like, so it says in the Talmud, Esav sone et Yaakov, halacha Moshe Mesinai. It's a law of Moses from Mount Sinai that Esau, you know, the West, Europe and the United States, they hate
but
Jacob.
But the truth is, in my opinion, is he an anti-Semite? Is he not an anti-Semite? Really isn't our job to judge him? Isn't our job to do that? The bottom line is, I think that the truth should speak for itself, and I think that the fact that so many of the things were just based on either distorted truths or Arafat changing his stripes, all of these ideas were obviously not true, and I think the truth spoke for itself.
That's true. But what I heard from a lot of the, you know, the videos I saw and what I read is that, you know, he makes this moral equivocation, this moral relativism, saying, you know, the Zionists, the original founding Zionists, even two of the prime ministers, they were terrorists, somehow equating the terror of Hamas with the terror of the Irgun, where they would bomb the King David Hotel, call ahead of time, let them know it was a political bombing in order to make sure the Jews were able to leave Germany and establish a Jewish state, the only Jewish state in the entire world, where there's 23 it's difficult for me to make up my mind what he really is, but I would like to say that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., when he wrote this letter to his friend who is an anti-Zionist, he says towards the end, he says, "My friend, I do not accuse you of deliberate anti-Semitism. I know you feel as I do a deep love of truth and justice and a revulsion for racism, prejudice, and discrimination. But I know you have been misled, as others have been, into thinking you can be an anti-Zionist and yet remain true to these heartfelt principles that you and I share." And I think that that's really the approach that we should take with him, because he did come on the show and he did join us. Anyways, we have with us Rob from Philadelphia. Rob, please ask your question.
Hey guys, how you doing? You did a great job interviewing somebody who, it's like I said to Ben, he's one of these guys, you could beat your head against a brick wall. He's a brick wall. He's never going to change. If he was a Jew, he would have converted in Spain when they kicked out the Jews. If he was a Jew in World War II, he would have been one of those ones that oversaw the, you know, worked with the Nazis to keep, you know, to march us to the ovens. These kind of people live in a world that's a dream world. They have no concept of reality because they've never participated in it. He's never, it's like a politician, that, you know, somebody that graduates from college and gets into politics. And they never have a real job. They don't know what it is to earn a living. They only know what it is to get paid. And I just think the guy was full of crap, to be honest with you. I think he's deluded himself into believing what he believes. And it doesn't matter whether it's the truth or it's a lie. We all know what the truth is. And the fact of the matter is what you guys have said. You've got all these Arab countries. They've got all this land. And the first thing that he's lied to himself about is there's a such people as Palestinians. The only Palestinians I've ever known were Jews. And
Jeremy's grandfather was a Palestinian.
Well, these people are Arabs. They're Egyptians. They're Syrians. They're Lebanese. I mean, these people, guys like this ought to be happy that the Jews don't take all the land that was given to us by Hashem. From the Euphrates to the Mediterranean. I mean, you know, look, the next Holocaust is going to occur in the United States, and it's not only going to be Jews that didn't make Aliyah, it's going to be Christians too.
Well, and I'll tell you, Rob, what you're saying, I mean, I can't help but I think that that your views are right on. And I'll tell you that his view comes from, you know, he's secular. He's an academic. He doesn't, you know, see God in the world. And for a secular person to try to understand the Islamic world is virtually impossible, because he doesn't believe. These people believe so strongly that they're not ready to only kill themselves. They're ready to sacrifice their children to blow their children up for their God. And for them to understand this jihad against the world, it's just unfathomable for them.
But I think it also comes from a certain amount of arrogance in insisting that the world, the entire world, sees itself through the same prism that he does.
Well, and he's never had to suffer. He's never gone hungry. He's never missed a meal. He's never had to walk somewhere. He's always had a ride. Somebody's always paid his ticket. And all he does to earn a living is talk.
Well,
and
I think what
maybe
you said,
write a book.
I think what you said about, you know, possible danger for the Jews, possibly the Christians that support the Jews in America is next. It's books like this that people that are going out, that are written by professors, that are written by scholarly men, that are, you know, that stand in the backbone of American education, that are saying it's Israel's fault. And who's Israel? It's the Jews' fault. And all those who love the Jew and all those who support Israel, it's their fault that America's being attacked now. It's their fault that America's being hated now. All of the problems that America's going through is all because of the Jew. It's like old school anti-Semitism, but in such a sophisticated new manner. It's probably the most dangerous thing out there on the market today.
Well, and where it's happening is the worst possible place. I didn't notice him mention in his book the cartoons on Palestinian TV that murdered the American president, that murdered the Jew, you're the Israeli. And, you know, it's funny, when they murder the Israeli, they don't distinguish between Jew, black Jew, white Jew. It's just Jew. They even murder other Arabs. When they don't have Jews to kill, they kill each other. And the bottom line is, the same thing that sets up what caused the Holocaust, what's caused the killing, mass killing of our people throughout history, is occurring now in the United States, and it will occur around the world as an economic collapse. And, I mean, you know, I'll listen to guys like on Redemption 5768, and you listen to what these guys say, and other folks like yourselves and on your show, and there are people that want to have sympathy for the average person out there. And, you know, who's helping in Myanmar? Who's helping in China? It's Jews and it's Israelis that go there and they help. And they may be hated. When Iran had their earthquake, all the Iranians publicly, we don't want any help from Israel, but they took the help.
And Israel was also willing to send them out everywhere. Rob, thank you for joining us so much. Very incredible insights. You know, what he's saying is true. They attack each other. I don't know how, you know, Professor Walt can expect us to make peace with Arabs, and they can't even make peace amongst themselves. I'm sure he's against the genocide in Darfur. The genocide in Darfur, what's happening? It's Arab Muslims killing black Muslims because they're black. I mean, there's all throughout the world this is happening. I just don't understand it. But I just have to say, one thing that happened as I was researching for this is I saw that, you know, Professor Walt, who is his co-author of the book, he's the Kennedy School of Government, the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Politics at Harvard. Now, I was like, Robert and Renee Belfer? I know that name. Oh, that was the building that I would attend classes in, that I would pass out in Yeshiva University throughout my entire education. Yeshiva University, the biggest building is Belfer Hall. So I said, could that possibly be the same Belfer? Could it be? And it turns out that absolutely was. And I want to just say before I go into this, that we talk often about, you know, the Jewish concept of midah keneged midah, attribute for attribute. And really, Belfer, he gave $7.5 million and essentially funded the chair that Professor Walt was sitting in, the platform that he used to write this book. Belfer funded this book, and written in this book of Israel Lobby condemns Belfer himself as being a member of the Israel Lobby. And, you know, he called the university and he was very angry. How could you not be angry? How could you not be furious that you've done all this to say, I don't only support Israeli and Jewish causes, I support Harvard, I support University of Chicago, I support all of these liberal institutions to prove that I don't have dual loyalties, to prove that that's... And then he himself gets from his donation, from his funding, he's accused of this. It's wild. It's almost like the Democrats, so many Jews, Steven Spielberg gave, what, I believe it was $2.2 million to Barack Obama's campaign, where he talks about the black liberation movement. His Pastor Wright and Che Guevara, that's the type of ideology that is employed by Barack Obama, and they think that by funding this campaign, somehow they will be exempt or safe when it turns on the Jews. And that's exactly what poor Mr. Belfer. You know, that's what he's going through.
I mean, you just imagine $7.5 million.
You know what we could have done with that?
Oh, my goodness. We would change the face of Israel. What, in $7.5 million, he funded his own downfall.
Feel like, give us $75. And,
you know, so what is that really all about? I mean, you think about the American Jewish community now. And this book, Israel Lobby, isn't just an obscure book that's out somewhere and no one really knows about it. It's been on the bestsellers list for a long time. hundreds of thousands of people bought it, read it, and liked it, saw the ideas, saw what they wanted to see, and said, you know what? There is a lobby for Israel. And you know what? It's against America's interest. Look, these are Harvard professors. Professors of, and they write so well. They're so
very
they're so
polite.
Well,
he was probably a little bit more polite than we were, but we were very excited, you know. But absolutely. I mean, the presentation is very academic and very, you know, calm. And
you just,
I mean,
see signs all around that the Jewish people outside of Israel really are not that safe. The security that they feel there is truly just an illusion. And I don't think that people should make Aliyah because they're scared of where they are. I mean, sometimes, you know, in France or in Argentina, sometimes that's the case. But I think that American Jews should really take close notice.
Just be aware. You know, just a few, when was it? In May. Where was it? Let me just try to think. The Jerusalem Post, it carried a headline, Harvard Study, AIPAC Leads U.S. to Act Against Own Interests. This was followed by a headline that read, The Israel Conspiracy in the Wall Street Journal. And then, Who's Afraid of the Israel Lobby in the Los Angeles Times. This is mainstream. This is a big deal. We can't put our head in the sand anymore and not realize what's happening and what the next threat is. And it's not the Ku Klux Klan. They're not our next threat. Our next threat is exactly this type of thing. And it's difficult to blame Americans for this, because the bottom line is, if they were to see the world through this prism, and they don't see it through a religious prism, just like he said, we presented that this is a religious argument, and his answer was simply, I'm sorry, professors and academics would not accept that type of argument. Okay, so they may not accept that type of argument, but that's not the type of, you know, intellectual honesty that I would expect to hear. I would expect to say, okay, so let's go and argue based on those points. But they don't accept that point. So really, what do Americans see? They see, why are we bother supporting Israel? Right or not right? Moral or not moral? Why should we bother supporting Israel? Look at the 1.3 billion Muslims around the world. All we have to do is back away from Israel. Why are we supporting Israel at all? This war in Iraq and now this new war in Iran. Why are we doing it? Wow. Look at AIPAC. Look at that. You know, it's a real threat. And while AIPAC has really good motivations and intentions, and they're trying to do the right thing, not only for Israel, and for America. And he even says that in the book. He says they're trying to do the right thing. They're trying. You know, he says AIPAC is American as apple pie. It's an American thing. There's other lobby interests. They're trying to do the right thing for America in their own perception.
Well, so wild to me about the interview is he sounds like such a nice guy. He was so polite, so he sounded like such a sincere guy. And you know, I'm just wondering. You know, in his book, you know, he talks about the Arab refugees that during the wars, you know, fled from Israel into Jordan, and you know, fled from they were from Jordan, they were from Syria, they just went back to where they originally came from, but. You know, he talks about the plight of the Arab refugees. And, you know, I just wonder, where is his call for over 700,000 Jews that were expelled from Arab countries in 1948? Where is the justice? They were expelled with the shirts on their back. All of their property, all of their money, all of their possessions were confiscated. And they had nowhere else to go but Israel. Why isn't there a call for justice for the over 700,000 Jews that were expelled from Arab countries?
It's true. I mean, there's so, and you asked a question. I remember I was down in Gaza and I was picked up and carried out along with people who had been there for generations, people whose family members had died merely for being Jews there. And they took every last Jew out of Gaza. And essentially, while he doesn't say we want the ethnic cleansing of, he's like, we don't call for the ethnic cleansing. He was talking about the words, but in reality, that's exactly what he's saying. I was ethnically cleansed out of Gaza. There's not one Jew left. And not only that, they left the synagogue standing. There was defecation smeared throughout the walls. It was burned and destroyed violently. And but yet in Israel, we have 1.5 million Arab Israeli citizens. I don't. That is one thing that I just don't get. It goes right over my head how this whole thing, and also the way he attributes it to the 1967 borders as if that's when the conflict started. Like there weren't massacres of Jews in Hebron in 1929. Like there's no history before that. You know, it's just difficult to reconcile.
So what do you think the Jewish people's response should be in America to this book? What do you think they should do? Should they ignore it? Should they debate him like we did? What should they do?
I think it would. They should, first of all, end the apathy, because the apathy is the biggest challenge. It doesn't matter if they come to the same conclusions, but they need to really investigate it with an intellectual curiosity, an intellectual honesty, and see the possible consequences that can come. You know, that's what vision is about. It's not about seeing what is right now, but about what can be. And when Iran actually has this nuclear weapon, and it's clear and the whole world agrees to it, then, you know, he may say, listen, I don't want to use this. All I'm asking is for America to completely turn on Israel. And then that really, when you say turn on Israel, Israel is the Jew among the nations. And depending on whether there is terror, because, you know, Ahmadinejad does have this messianic complex. And he is not the rational foe that we were facing with the Soviet Union that didn't want to be destroyed. He doesn't mind absorbing a nuke or two. And with a type of leader like that, America is going to turn its back on Israel. And so will the European Union and Micronesia and everyone else. And if Jews in America think that that situation would render them safe just because they will say, yeah, yeah, we're with you, America. We don't mind turning our backs on Israel. The question is whether there's a historical precedent to ever think that a Jew can be separated as far as his fate from the rest of the Jewish people or the rest of Israel.
Well, that's what's so funny. You see now the Belfer Hall, where, you know, trying so hard to be accepted, funding Barack Obama. In the end of the day, all of the Jewish people are one family. And no matter what happens, where we go, we all go together. And I think that's what the call of all of this is that we really need Jewish unity. If you're secular, if you're religious, if you're right, if you're left, in the end of the day, our destinies are intertwined. We all are part of the same people. We're all part of the same family. And if we don't unite, stand up for each other, speak out on behalf of each other, then where do we stand? Right now, Ari and I mean, Israel lobby doesn't affect us really one way or the other. It's really, it puts American Jews in a very peculiar spot of dual loyalty. What's happening? Who are we? What are we fighting for? But Ari and I see all of the Jewish people as one family. And we see that an injustice is being done, and we have to speak out on behalf
of them. And we would have no problem if the Jews of America were in danger, absolutely expanding our reach on a military level to get them out to protect American Jews or Jews anywhere throughout the world, because that's what any responsible Israeli government would do. Just one thing I want to make, a point that I want to make. He was saying that, you know, Al-Qaeda was targeting the U.S. This all was sparked by 9/11. But Osama bin Laden, what was he so angry about? That after Saddam invaded Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia, Saudi brought in the U.S.'s help, which rather than, you know, Obama's Mujahideen, which is, of course, a sacrilege to have infidels in the United in Saudi Arabia. And that was really the cause that sparked the hatred that he had for America. And Israel wasn't even attacked. No Israeli targets, nor was Israel even attacked by Osama bin Laden until after 9/11. I mean, that's why I have such a problem with this, because even his facts are mistaken. It's time to really investigate this issue, seek truth and seek understanding, because these are volatile times and it's a very critical issue. Shalom Aleichem from Beit El Israel.
Whew, I gotta get in shape. I gotta call Michael Berezin at Jerusalem Fitness.
054-625-0269.
Shalom. You've reached Michael Berezin, Jerusalem Fitness. You've taken the first step toward health and wellness. Please leave us a message and we will get back to you to schedule your free consultation.
That's Michael Berezin, Jerusalem Fitness, for classes, personal trainers, and more on Pierre Koenig Street in Jerusalem. Call Jerusalem Fitness at 054-625-0269.
Camp Moshe Vav Wild Rose is excited to announce the opening of our new Aquapark Adventure Playground, featuring a giant water slide, trampoline, and much more. A great tradition of fun and friendship for over 70 years in a great religious Zionist program. We offer a $1,000 new camper incentive. Space is still available for campers in grades 3 to 10. Call us at 847-674-9733 or visit moshavawildrose.org.